From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. What a program we have for you tonight. Later on, Alien Technology with William Henry. Now, here's what's happening. Yahoo has announced that hackers stole data from more than, get this, 1 billion customer accounts. In a statement, Yahoo's chief information security officer, Bob Lord, said that the unauthorized third party back in August of 2013 stole data associated with more than 1 billion user accounts. Lord explained that the breach was found by analyzing data files provided by law enforcement that an unnamed third party claimed was Yahoo user data. And what a mess that is. Yahoo, by the way, sending out messages to everybody today saying you might want to change your password and some other things to try to make your emails a little more secure. In technology, giant IBM said it will hire 25,000 people in the United States over the next 4 years ahead of a meeting between President-elect Donald Trump and tech industry leaders. About 6,000 of those appointments will be made in 2017. The IBM chief executive, Ginni Rometty, wrote in an opinion article published in USA Today, IBM will invest $1 billion in employee training and development over the next 4 years. Well, as we predicted, after a year of anticipation and carefully choreographed public messaging, the Federal Reserve has pulled the trigger on raising the short-term federal funds rate, the interest rate, for only the second time since 2006, and boosted its outlook for the future path of rate increases. So here we go. The unanimous decision to hike rates by 0.25% point to a range of 0.50 to 0.75 came at the conclusion of their policy setting meeting. Let's check in with investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, I think it's too early to raise rates. I don't know what's going to happen now.
George, I don't think it's too early to raise, because if you look at what's been happening to the pension funds and insurance companies, one of the reasons we're staring down very bad deficits in the pension funds is they have not been able to make their target rates. In fact, we just saw CalPERS come out this week and say we're going to have to cut our target rate, which means municipalities all over California are now going to have larger amounts they have to contribute. So, you know, if you look at what was expected, rates peaked, the Fed funds rate peaked in the 80s, say 1980 at 18%, and it's been coming down ever since, and now it's been at almost zero for quite a while. So there are a lot of people who depend on interest rates, particularly savers, who are really hurting, and I think that's part of the pressure on the Fed.
Do you think this will have any effect on housing sales?
Well, here's what's interesting. If you look at what the Fed did, they're just bumping the Fed funds target rate. The actual rate is set by negotiation by the depository institutions as they lend their reserves back and forth. But as a matter of habit and what we're seeing in the market, the depository institution, the banks, are raising their loan rates. They're not raising the deposit rates that we get, which means they're making more money on their loans. And, in fact, if you look at the bank stocks and, for example, the regional bank ETF, is one of the best performing ETFs this year. It's up 32% for the year. So investors clearly think this means more profits for the banks.
All right, we shall see. And Catherine, by the way, if we don't talk to you before this, please have a wonderful Christmas.
You know, George, and just Merry Christmas to you and Tom and Lisa and the whole team. And just thank you on behalf of your whole audience for how much you do for all of America.
Thank you. Catherine Austin Fitz. The unsolved murder case of 6-year-old then JonBenet Ramsey took a step forward when Colorado police and prosecutors have announced that they would look into new DNA testing technology. The move came after an investigation by the Boulder Daily Camera in KUSA Television in Denver that apparently uncovered flaws in the interpretation of previous DNA testing. The Boulder County District Attorney Stan Garnett and Boulder Police Chief Greg Testa confirmed that they have discussed the issue with the Colorado Bureau of Investigative Administrators, who are about to unveil more sophisticated DNA tests. At the time, 6-year-old JonBenet was found dead in the basement of the Ramsey home the day after Christmas in 1996. In 2008, prosecutors cleared her parents and her brother, saying DNA on the girl's clothes did not match anyone in the family. But now there's going to be more testing. A man who set out to eat nothing but potatoes for an entire year has said that in addition to shaving off more than 100 pounds, he's come off antidepressants and his cholesterol levels have lowered. Andrew Taylor of Melbourne, Australia, said that while he was criticized for his diet at first, it helped him break his addiction to unhealthy food. Viruses can evolve to become more aggressive in men than in women, at least in theory, according to a study. Some infections are known to be less deadly in women, but this is largely put down to differences in the immune system. But now they're saying that the viruses can evolve to become more aggressive in men. Why? Let's check in with Dr. Gary Ridenour. This is a strange one, Gary. Why is this?
Well, this is the old men versus women discussion that's been around for years. And first thing you have to remember is that women outlive men by 10 to 15 years. And with men, testosterone and the man cave thinking causes men to push themselves more and more and more, and they usually crash harder. In women, estrogen slows down viral growth, whereas testosterone will not do it. And then, of course, George, you've heard this, that why are men such babies when they get sick? And the answer to that is that men have more receptors in their brains that fire off and make them feel worse. But on the other hand, women are more resistant because they're exposed to their children and other moms and their kids, so they're a little bit more resistant to the viruses. The odd thing is that when you look at European studies, they're reversed. The Europeans say women get sicker and that because they go to the doctor more often. My reply is, yes, women do go to the doctor more often because men are cheap. My opinion is women win this battle.
All right. Thank you, Gary. So what a strange story it is, but they say viruses attack men more than women. Interesting take there. In a moment, we're going to talk about Mars, our future on the red planet. Leonard David joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Leonard David is an award-winning space journalist who has been reporting on space activities for more than 50 years. He frequently contributes to the website space.com, great website, by the way, as their Space Insider columnist. He's also the co-author of Buzz Aldrin's Mission to Mars. In 2015, he became the first recipient of the American Astronautical Society's Ordway Award for Sustained Excellence in Spaceflight History, and here he is on Coast to Coast, his book, Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet. We're going to have some fun talking about this tonight. Leonard, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. So we lost John Glenn last week, and I had heard that Buzz Aldrin got sick down in, where was he?
Antarctica.
Antarctica. How is he doing? Yeah. Have you checked in with him, Leonard?
Yeah, I just talked to him, just yesterday, in fact. And, he sounds great. He got some pneumonia down there. He actually walked around for a little bit. It was a big thing for him. He really wanted to get down there and spend some time. And because of his interest in Mars and how isolated and remote that area is. So anyway, but he's back. He's already cooking up some new ideas about going to Mars. So
he hasn't stopped. What is he? He's 86 years old, isn't he?
He's out there. Yeah, yeah. He's quite a thinker. It was a great pleasure to work on a book with him, and I've known him a long time, and he's just amazing. You know, he keeps going.
I'll always remember that day that Bart Sobral guy put a Bible in front of his face and said, "Swear on the Bible that you went to the moon."
Yeah.
I'll remember that.
I think he punched him in the face.
He did. He did. So what's the latest on our mission to Mars? I mean, we've been sending robots up there, you know, robotic craft for years. We're getting great data. What's happening with the mission of a person up there?
Well, you know, the robots have rule on Mars right now, and they're doing a pretty good job. I mean, Curiosity is the one-ton rover that's been there since August of 2012. NASA launched that, and actually they just had a major meeting in San Francisco that's going on and announced some new findings from Curiosity. It's been there for quite a while. The thing is, you got to remember about the rover, it's pretty It moves a little bit, does a lot of science. Right now, the drill is screwed up somehow. They're trying to fix that. But it's gone about 9 miles since it landed. And I don't want to, discount its scientific objectives, but, I mean, a field geologist, a human on Mars would have done that pretty much in a day and a half.
Right, right. And it has lived long beyond what they thought it would, hasn't it?
Well, this one is a nuclear-powered one, and it's going pretty well. There's another rover, Opportunity, that's in a different place on Mars, and it's actually been there a lot longer and has solar power, and it kind of is doing a very good job as well. So we got two robots that are running around on Mars, and it's a get-to-know-you planet. I mean, it's, to me, Mars is, and this is what I wrote in the book, it's pretty surprising. It always offers something bizarre and a twist to the tale. And certainly, is there life on Mars? We've been asking that for decades, and we're getting there with the answer. But my guess is humans are going to have to get down there on the surface.
Yep.
and really pinpoint exactly what's happening.
Well, we'll get into the possibilities of when you think that might happen. You've been doing this, writing and reporting on space events for 50-plus years. What would you say are some of the amazing highlights over the 50 years, Leonard, that you've covered?
Well, it is. I just hit 70, so...
Oh, good for you. Keep going.
Yeah, I'm hanging on. And I grew up in the space race, the space age, getting moving with Sputnik and the former Soviet Union, and it's been a tremendous, number of events over the decades. Probably the saddest things that I've got had to cover was Columbia and the Challenger.
Oh, God, yeah.
Where you lose people, and that's just that's a heartbreaker. But on the other hand, there's been a lot of successes in the human spaceflight program, and then you have all the tremendous capabilities that are imbued in robots, and they're everywhere. They just shot one by Pluto. That is one thing that happened in my lifetime. I lost a planet. I mean, Pluto, I had to memorize those planets,
mm-hmm.
As a kid, get all those nine right in sequence.
Right in an order, that's right.
Yeah, and they canceled out Pluto on me. But, on the other hand, exoplanets and how many, we're up, a huge number of exoplanets have been found. So I lost one planet and gained quite a number.
Did you always think when you were a kid that there were other planets outside our solar system? I did.
Oh, yeah, I did. But it's odd to say that, in all the astronomy books and anything you were reading as a kid growing up, that we were it. This was like it. We had nine planets. And so that discovery, and then you get into extraterrestrial intelligence and who's out there. And one of the penalties as a writer when you're up at 3 or 4 in the morning and you can't finish the study article is, you do "Are We Alone?" With a question mark. And it's changed. It's really how crowded is it today? And that's the question I think we're getting to. And that's another realm of excitement. And Mars exploration helps in that regard.
Have you ever gotten from anybody yet a satisfactory answer about the Big Bang and how it all started?
I'll be honest with you. I get books in the mail. I look at them, and I still I don't get it yet.
I'm the same. Leonard, I'm the same. Every physicist and astronomer that I have interviewed over 14-plus years on this show and more even before that, I ask that same question, and they all try to give me their honest answer. And it comes down to me saying, how could something start from nothing? And I just don't get it.
Yeah, I buy them to make my neighborhood people that walk through looks good. When you have the physics books on the shelf there. But I'm still trying to, it's not even that. It's just the, wormholes and black holes. And then you got string theory. And I always feel in my guts. But on the other hand, I was a C student in physics, so you can't count on me too much. But it seems like we're groveling on a lot of these theoretical things. And when we grovel a lot, I always figure we're really wrong, and somebody will come out with something that'll be the aha moment, and it'll sort of all make sense. I'm still waiting for that book to show up.
You mentioned Challenger and Columbia. Challenger, of course, exploding January 1986. Seven astronauts, of course, died in that horrible situation. Do you remember where you were, what you were doing at that time?
On Challenger, yeah, it was, yeah, I mean, what happened, I was actually working on a government study, the National Commission on Space, and we were all there in our in L'Enfant Plaza in Washington, D.C. This was a government report to the White House, and we had just kind of got to the end of the study, and then I brought my little TV in, and we were sitting there watching the launch on the little TV. And, you know, I was down at Florida for quite a number of shuttle launches and had seen a number on TV. And, you know, when it took off, it didn't sound right. I don't know what – it still sticks to my mind. Maybe it was because I was watching on a small TV, but I don't know. The sound didn't sound right. And, you know, all of a sudden it blows up, and a couple of us ran over to NASA headquarters and sat in a room where you sort of got a better view of recovery of pieces, and you kept thinking that somehow the astronauts would somehow be found, and you kept holding on
mm-hmm.
to hope, you know, and it just went on and on for hours, and then to realize you just lost seven people was a tough one.
Yeah, that was.
Columbia, same thing. It's just, you know, just a you know, mishap on reentry. But that story to me has not been told yet. I still have a lot of problems with some of the findings of why that shuttle.
Really? Now, what do you think? What do you think might have happened here? Because wasn't that the they talked about some of the brick plates on the wings fell off or
yeah,
something like
it,
that?
You know, the carbon, you know, wing structure apparently had a foam hit and broke a hole in the wing and let all that reentry plasma into the inside of the wing and gutted it. I guess what I'm talking about is I personally, my view in talking to a lot of people, and I went down and had to sit there and listen to a lot of people talk about the accident. And I, you know, in my view, there was a lot of early warning in orbit of that problem, and whether or not we could have had a spacewalk, let an astronaut actually go out there and inspect the wing and see something mm-hmm. really wrong. And then from then on, and that could have been like day two of a 16-day mission,
right?
You would have a Apollo 13 like you wouldn't believe. Instead of NASA's worst hour, it would have been the finest because we would still have seven people
yep.
back here
exactly.
on Earth.
Could we have gotten another shuttle up to help it?
There was one that was on the pad. They were readying. And, yeah, there's a lot of scenarios, and there are multiple ideas that people tell you now could have been done. But I don't want to dwell on this too much, but, I mean, I just think there was early warning, and unfortunately it wasn't heeded, and people were kind of ringing the bells in various parts of NASA that we ought to take a look at that wing, and it just didn't go up the high echelons enough and persistent enough. But it's a long story, and there's a lot of little things I've found
yeah.
over the years that I hope to write in the next book.
And we are with Leonard David, and his book is called Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet, which we will get into in a big way. He's with us for a couple hours tonight. We will take calls next hour as well. I think it's exciting that we will go to Mars. Will we come back? Will these people who go to Mars, Leonard, will they stay, or will they be able to get back in a ship and get back here?
Well, you know, right now there's lots of interest in, you know, returning. I think we've got a lot of capability in spacecraft and also the resources of Mars that you can utilize to make propellant, oxygen, fuel, and use that and refuel the ship and come back. there is a group, you know, kind of a one-way to Mars, and they've got people that have signed up. Very interesting. I've talked to a couple of the people that have signed up for the one-way trip, and they're, you know, they're pioneers in their own right, in their own mind, you know, that they want to do this incredible adventure. But I think when you think about Elon Musk and some of his recent
Hold on for a second, Leonard. We're at the break, but we're going to come back. We'll pick it up right there when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.
Coast Insiders, the new version of the Coast to Coast AM app is now available for iPhone and now Android 4.0 and above. Listen live or on demand anywhere, anytime. Go to coasttocoastam.com and download it today.
Welcome back to Coast, Leonard David with us. We'll be back to talk more about his work, Mars, Our Future, on the Red Planet. Exciting stuff, really is. Hey, are you a Coast Insider yet? Giving it away as a gift, keeping it for yourself. It's a great way to become part of the program. If you don't get it from me, you'll get it from these insiders.
Hi, this is Angelina in Redondo Beach, and I love being a Coast to Coast Insider because I can tune in at any time of day.
Hi, I'm Julio from Slidell, Louisiana. And I really like being an insider because of all the interesting information.
Hi, this is Ariel from San Diego, California. And I love being a Coast Insider because I can listen to any show, anytime, anywhere, if I'm in the garden or in the kitchen, taking a walk on the beach. And there's no more sleepless nights for me. It's amazing. Give it a try.
Give it a try indeed. Go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Look for the section where it says Coast Insiders. And for 15 cents a day, you can sign up. Welcome back. Leonard David with us as we talk about Mars and space as well. And Leonard, we were talking about the one-way mission to Mars. Man, that would be tough for me to want to do that. You know, there's too many things on this planet, the people I care about, that I'd miss. I'm not sure I'd do that. Why would some of these folks want to do that?
Well, you know, it is, you know, it's a pioneering spirit that people that do space exploration and travel and, you know, point to point from, you know, into Earth orbit and then beyond. I mean, it's going to be a long haul, 6 to 9 months to get there, hang around the planet, 6 to 9 months coming back. So, yeah, there are people that want to do a one-way trip, and you know, Elon Musk, as I was talking about, you know, has put together a colonization of Mars plan, very interesting. He's the SpaceX rocketeer and Tesla designer. So I don't know. You know, it's a special kind of person. I think you're right, though. What is it exactly in the makeup of somebody that would do this kind of? I wrote about it a little bit in the book on that particular question. What kind of people would really go on these kind of missions? So, you know, it's not just engineers. I mean, even though things are going to break down on Mars, mm-hmm. you're going to have astrobiologists, somewhere in the long haul. You're going to have a medical doctor, I would assume cooks at some point. We'll see. But I do think that the future of getting to Mars with humans is going to be tough. It's going to be very hard, and it's the pioneering aspect of it, and then people will die. And on the other hand, we were talking about Buzz Aldrin. I mean, Buzz is working on a cycling spaceship concepts where, you have a routine transportation system between Earth and Mars. And who's to say, just exactly how onerous in the future getting to Mars will be? My guess is it's going to be a lot quicker and faster.
Mm-hmm.
And every form of transportation on the planet we've seen over the decades has changed. And we can get point to point on Earth faster and more economical and this and that. So I expect space travel to be the same.
I think so, too. Once they develop some kind of new scientific formula, some way to bend space and time, maybe.
It could be in those physics books where we can't get any answers.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Well, it's going to be exciting. There's no doubt about that.
I think the link between Earth and Mars will change. And, my view is that Mars is a bit of a metaphor for exploration. It's got a lot of things going on there, but it's a stepping stone to some other locations. And getting our technological wherewithal together to do that type of exploration is just kind of a little bit on the destiny side of humans and what we do here on the planet to explore. So we'll see. But like I said, I'm 70 years old. We got to get on with it. I just want to make sure we got people en route.
That's right. You want to watch that?
Yeah, I'm kind of anxious. I've seen the robots do it, and it's hair-raising. You go to Jet Propulsion Lab on these landings on Mars and with the robots, and I've seen a good number of those come in, and, it's just your nail-biting time. Will a parachute open with a retro rocket?
Well, we got to the moon with 50-year-old technology. The technology today is amazing, and I think, didn't Buzz have to use a Bic pen to push a button to get lifted off the moon?
Yeah, he did that. I tell you, every time I was, like I said, we worked on this book together, and one of the most enjoyable times of my life has been going on the road with him and these book tours. And my job is to keep him on track on the stage, and we're sitting there talking, and every time we were on the stage, he always has another little tidbit of info.
Yeah. He does. I was on Larry King's show with him a couple of years ago, before Larry retired, and Larry would ask Buzz a specific question, and Buzz would wander off into some other area and eventually circle the wagons and come back, and you could just see Larry go, "I'm running out of time here."
He's a fascinating character, and his passion for Mars, even in the book we wrote together, that was the goal of the book, is to say, let's do it, let's get on, let's look at America, what our space program. And we're sort of there. I think the new administration, every time a new administration comes in, it's interesting. I'm kind of a survivor of 30 years living in Washington, D.C. I almost have stopped shaking. But being there and watching presidents come in, every one of these folks has got to look at NASA and say, okay, what's the space program mean for America right now?
That's right.
We've got another iteration of what the space program means to the public, and we'll see what President-elect Trump comes up with. But there's definitely a lot on the table right now, because we are kind of in a, like you said, new technological capabilities, and we can go pretty far.
We have devoted, since the inception of this show, Leonard, a lot of time and programs to the investigation and the study of extraterrestrial life, UFOs, and those kinds of mysteries. We take it seriously. We've got some great researchers and guests who take it seriously. What are your thoughts on that? Because, I mean, you grew up in the era where, part of the media covered it sensationally. The other half covered it seriously. That legend, the UFO legend, George Adamski, who claimed that he was flown to Venus every once in a while. We had all those things going on. But what do you think about UFOs visiting us and intelligent life out there in space?
Well, it's a great topic. Personally, as a kid growing up in San Diego, I was born in 46, and so I spent a good chunk of my time in San Diego as a kid. And George Adamski was always coming down from Mount Palomar, where he lived, and with another story of he just got back from Venus, and he said it was very hot, so he must be real.
Yeah, that's right.
Over the decades, though, and I find the UFO phenomenon fascinating for a lot of reasons, but maybe not as much of a twist of the tail as some of your listeners, but there's some signal in that, and I'm not sure what it is yet in my own mind. As a kid, though, the potential for hucksterism in the UFO community still is rampant.
Oh, sure. It's huge.
And I find that I've gone to quite a number of conferences. I still go to MUFON conferences every once in a while and check in with people and see where they're going. I do salute MUFON in particular, and also like Leslie Keene and a couple other people that really try to put some scientific...
They're very serious about it.
...guts into the thing. There's something in this phenomenon and that's worthy of study. I was very lucky when I was a kid early on to communicate with Alan Hynek.
I was just going to bring him up. I mean, there was a guy... If one is a doubter about UFOs, look at the way he changed, going from the consultant to Project Blue Book, calling it swamp gas, to swinging around to being a staunch believer that this planet was being visited.
Yeah, well, he's a very interesting character, and he provided some scientific wherewithal, to start looking at it, and a number of other people have done the same. And so I go to that route. I think there's something in the signal. I'm not sure how loud it is or how clear it is, but I think it's worth looking at. Again, I think the ability of people to make money off of people's fascination with UFOs is worrisome. It just gets more bizarre every hour, it seems like, with some of the things I see.
Some of the things that are out there, yeah.
On the web, yeah. So... But the big picture about extraterrestrial intelligence, I mean, we have a one of the things I did cover in 92 was when they flipped the switch on the Arecibo radio telescope. It was a federally funded government study to listen for signals. I was down there with some really heavyweights, in the SETI world, and watching that facility being used in that way was pretty exciting.
Do you know Seth Shostak?
Oh, yeah, I know Seth very well,
guy.
And Jill Tarter and Frank Gray.
They're all great people.
Incredible minds, and they've been pounding the pavement on this saga for quite a while now with private money. I think one of the big things that's happening is Yuri Milner now, the Russian entrepreneur, has got breakthrough technologies that he's pushing that are very interesting and putting money into radio observatory time on some of the big scopes, radio telescopes around the globe. So it's not that people aren't listening and then trying to figure out, okay, if we find other intelligent life, then you get into the sub themes, which is, should we let them know we're here?
Hawking says no. Don't let them
know. You got worrisome people out there. I think the one thing that we're kind of guilty of here is we perhaps think it's one alien intelligence that we're trying to find. Maybe it's multitudes of of evolution that we're going to discover, and it is the Star Wars bar, you know. Not quite sure all those characters in there, what we're going to end up finding.
From afar, would they not know that this planet had water and atmosphere, elements, you know, oxygen, hydrogen, that we'd have it all here?
They would know that, right? Exactly. I mean, even today I looked at an article of, you know, the cloud patterns on exoplanets, or, you know, the next wave of from here on Earth is looking for biosignatures, not only at Mars, but using lots of instruments to look for biosignatures of possible extraterrestrial intelligence and intelligent civilizations out there. So, yeah, I mean, we're getting to a point in these telescopic observations with Jim Webb Space Telescope, and even before the thing's launched, there's like five or six other new telescope ideas that are coming that are pretty amazing. And space-based astronomy is taking a whole new tactic in the future looking for exoplanets. So we're going to learn a lot.
Leonard, though, your jury is still out on whether we've been visited by ETs. What do you think about the incredible possibility that there are many intelligent civilizations out there on other planetary systems? Maybe they haven't gotten here yet, but they're there.
Yeah, I do think, you know, here we are, we've launched probes outward. Why don't we think that other civilizations elsewhere have launched probes this way? I don't know. I think keeping your mind and eye open is a good thing. Frankly, the UFO scenarios that people paint here, you do wonder why, you know, are we a Stuckey's off ramp? I mean, why would we have so many UFOs coming here and scooting by? And I only need one, you know.
Yeah.
That would be exciting for me. I don't need them coming, you know, knocking on the door every hour and scooping up people and doing abduction scenarios and all that. So, you know, if life is pervasive, you know, what is it about Earth that's so, you know, so unique that we would be visited over and over again? So I don't know, you know, but I'm up for being surprised.
What do you think of the privatization of space? You like it?
Yeah, I mean, this has been another, you know, great opportunity for the future of space exploration is the private sector. I mean, Richard Branson, I've been to some of the Virgin Galactic tests of the Spaceship One and Spaceship Two, and watching the whole evolution of public space travel emerge, and that's exciting times. Then you have Bezos with Amazon. He's putting money into a space program, and you've got Robert Bigelow with his expandable habitats. I mean, so the privatization of space is certainly here, and we're seeing some results of that. And again, Elon Musk,
mm-hmm.
We'll see how SpaceX rolls out the next launch. He's had some problems and also a lot of success. So anyway, that's a wavelength that's happening in the space program on the private side that's certainly worth underscoring.
How do you think NASA will interact with these private companies?
They do it quite a bit. I mean, if you really get into the memorandums and Space Act agreements, and NASA's got a passion for being engaged with the private sector, and actually has worked out a memorandum with Elon Musk on his interest in going to Mars. Yeah, they're there. You know, you kind of have a kind of an odd thing to me. You know, the private sector was never not there in space program history as far as NASA. I mean, whether it was McDonnell Douglas building the Mercury capsule or Rockwell building the shuttle, I mean, you always had private sector involvement with the governments pouring a lot of money into the companies to build the capabilities. So it's been there. The key now is whether or not we'll see a shift of gears and there's private sector activity there on their own dollar, no government involvement. I assume we're going to get there at some point. Branson is very interesting to watch the space travel suborbital flight evolve out of that program. So, I mean, it's all good news as far as I'm concerned. And again, even with Branson, he had an accident. He lost one pilot, and the other guy barely got out of the spaceship. But he's just had another glide test, glide test of their new spaceship, too. So he's back in gear, and hopefully he'll be very successful with that.
Is there any country that could surpass us? I mean, the Chinese seem to be coming on strong.
I agree. Yeah, I spent a lot of time watching the Chinese, and it's not easy to watch the Chinese. It's not like you can dial them up and get NASA press releases out of them every day. But, yeah, I think that's the story to watch, frankly.
Yeah.
I think they have a lot of capability. They just got to space travelers down a couple weeks ago from their own space lab. They're talking about their own international space station in the 2020s. They're going to the moon the next year, and if they're successful, bring back samples from the moon robotically.
I mean, look how far ahead, Leonard, we were from all these other countries. I mean, we were in the space race with the Russians. We beat them. And then we were so far ahead of India, North Korea, China.
Yeah.
It seems like we kind of put our guard down, and some of these countries, including, you know, specifically China, caught up with us. And that's that's unacceptable to me.
We work with them, the Europeans, Space Agency. When you look at the International Space Station we have up there right now, I mean, the key word is international. There's like 16 nations working together on making that system keep moving.
I don't know what they're doing up there, but...
Well, there's quite a bit. It's one of those PR nightmares, I think. I think if you really peel back and talk to people who have lived and worked on the thing, I think you get a different story, but it's a complicated story. But I think there's a signal there about that, international, and whether or not the world community for a Mars mission may come together. You know, or is it the private sector or both working in tandem? I don't know what's going to happen. I just like the fact that other countries have an interest in space.
Well, I do too. Leonard, we're going to come back. Let's talk more about that, and we'll take an hour of phone calls with you from our listeners who love to talk about space.
Feeling lost? Not by your radio? Grab your smartphone or computer and listen to iHeartRadio. Pick up the free iHeartRadio apps in the App Store or go to iHeartRadio.com. Talk to George Norrie. Call the Wildcard line at 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is 818-501-4721. To talk toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, toll-free, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach George by calling their in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free. 800-893-0903. To reach George via Skype, use Skype name George97313. Send George a text message anytime at 818-298-6521. From the Gateway to the West, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Okay, while we talk about space, we'll also take your phone calls with our guest Leonard David. His book, Mars, our future on the red planet. His website, makemarshome.com, is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. So Skype is open, by the way, at George97313. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Leonard David. We're going to take your calls as we continue talking about space. You're talking about the International Space Station, Leonard, and the cooperation between all the countries that are up there. But thank God we've got the Russians to get us up there and back, huh?
Yeah, that's maybe coming to an end, but we'll see how this plays out. I think one of the other things to watch in the next year, a couple of years, is going to be the European Space Agency just had an important ministerial meeting where all the countries that are involved with the European Space Agency came together with a pretty healthy budget. The new head of that agency is really interested in the lunar village, and they're, you know, while NASA's been spending a lot of time going to Mars and trying to, and I write about that in the new book, there is a bifurcation going here about governments that are very interested in the moon. So we'll see. The moon's probably going to come back. I think even with this new administration, there just seem to be some of the people that are being tapped to consolidate some space plans for the country. We may see the moon come back in vogue. Here in the United States, but definitely the Europeans are playing their own role there and ginning up new interest in a lunar village.
Did you see the movie Interstellar?
Yeah.
What'd you think of that? And is any of that possible for us?
Oh yeah, I you know, all these films to me, I'm a big sci-fi movie fan.
Yeah.
Way back, I've got a collection of all the old ones I used to watch and as a kid. Yeah, they're all important. I think, you know, getting the public engaged in some of the lingo that's used. I know there's always people crowing about some technical issues or this or that, or gravity, doesn't it? The movie Gravity or The Martian or Deep Impact or, you know, whatever it is. You know, there's always, you know, people complaining about some technical issue. But I think it does get the public engaged in the hardware, getting a better look at, you know, what some of the problems that can be found in space flight. So it's all to the good. The Martian worried me, the movie.
Oh, yeah, it was a great movie, too.
It's a great movie, but I thought it got so real, I thought people would think it was shot on location, you know. I was worried about that one. But Gravity was very good on getting the public, you know, interested in orbital debris, even though they had a, you know, kind of clowned it up a bit there in the sense of how bad it would look. But I don't know. Apollo 13, you know, Ron Howard, he wrote the foreword to my book, actually. And Ron Howard, you know, did a great job of recapturing the angst that went on in that mission. Most of us didn't realize all the issues that were going along with Apollo 13 and trying to save those folks to come back, and he did a great job. Although I did an interview with him once, and he said, well, I got to go now, and I said, well, fine, thanks for the time. He says, we're going to put the sound effect for the explosion of the Apollo 13, you know, the service module. And I said, wait a minute, in space you can't hear any explosion. He said, this is Hollywood. So, you know, you always bend a little bit, but I think the public gets engaged in these films, and that's the best.
Well, one of the interesting things about that movie, The Martian, it was the Chinese who saved the guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, they're, you know, again, I'm not going to say it's a Sputnik moment, but I do feel that the Chinese have a bunch of things that are happening, not only in the civil side, but military side as well in space. But they, in the civil side, when you look, they just had people come out of a space simulation. I think it was 180 days I wrote. You know, they're very interested in long-term space exploration with humans. So, you know, they're going back to the moon. They're going to go to the moon with people and beyond. And in 2020, they're going to launch a rover to Mars. And, you know, you have to kind of piece it all together, and you go, okay, there's a lot of things flying in formation here, and if they lock all that together, they're going to have a pretty impressive moment in history.
Yeah, well, I think so, too. And before we take calls, your reaction to President-elect Trump, I haven't heard him say too much about the space program. Well, you know, he's whittling away at the Boeing and some other companies. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, you know, I'm lucky. I think some of the names on transition teams dedicated to putting together a plan for space, I know some of those folks, and, you know, they're good people. I think, as all administrations, you have to look at the space program in the context of the country. You know, just what does America feel about their space program? So that gets back to the public. I think the China card is going to be played, not only by in the U.S. and people worried, but China is going to play it themselves. So how that fits in politically in the context of the times today, all I know is that the transition people that are engaged in putting the space agenda together for Trump are good people with very visionary. So, you know, whether the humans to Mars mission folds into that or back to the moon or whatever it's going to be, I think the opportunity is to keep America on the rails of space after such a legacy of things we've done in the past.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Joey to get things started in Bonnie Lake, Washington. Hi, Joey. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, I was just calling to say I was thinking about the all this Trump and Putin talk. The Russian space station or the International Space Station, I heard the Russian part, whenever they decommissioned it, it was supposed to break off and they're going to continue to use it. So I was thinking that, you know, down the road, he's really working with Trump here. Maybe he would, you know, so it's compatible with the United States and all the other international parts. Maybe they'd take it over and, you know, redock with it. I don't know. Thoughts on you guys, and I love the show.
Okay, thanks, Joey. What are the Russians' role right now with the ISS, Leonard?
Well, they're still there, and they're doing a lot, but I think the question is that Joey brought up is a good one. And I mean, what is going to happen to this station? You know, we're talking about extending it. I'm starting to hear even now 2028, you know, of keeping it up there. Now, the Chinese want to do their own space station, and they're playing diplomatic niceties with other countries to use their space station. So, and then in my back of my mind, I'd like to see multiple space stations up there. We got multiple satellites, multiple countries build satellites. So why not space stations? And in case there's an emergency up there, maybe we'll transfer people back and forth in case there's some problems. But I think that the question Joey brought up is one that I'm fascinated with. What do we do with the space station when it's done? I mean, yeah, you can rip off modules and do something else with them, but at some point they're talking about reentering the whole thing. And that is a worry to me. I don't know how we're going to, you know, the plans are being laid of trying to deorbit that whole facility in one big fireball and hit the, you know, land it in the ocean. That's, you know, that's a lot of money going down the drain hole there.
Sure is.
We'll see. I just don't know, but it's a good question to keep in your mind.
Off to San Diego we go. Oscar's there, first-time caller. Hi, Oscar. Go ahead.
Hola, Jorge. ¿Cómo estás?
Good. Thank you.
Listen, once I was camping out in Salt Lake City with a group of Boy Scouts,
all right.
I just happened to be looking up on the skies, and out of nowhere, you see this like sort of like a star, like a falling star, but then out of that star, there were spaceships, and then looked at like kind of like a shark shape with little windows on it. And I was talking to my wife at the time, hey, something's happening here, and I counted 8 of them just coming out of nowhere, just white, dots, no lights flashing, no nothing. You can just see those white shapes just going eastbound. I did one, so I counted like about 3 minutes, 3 times, 1, 2, 3, and another one would appear out of nowhere, like a portal hole or like a falling star. And I just think that it's coming out of space from Mars, just like the movie Mars. Those spaceship look just like that. So I think there's something going on already up there that we don't know about.
There could be something up there indeed. But what about, Leonard, the secret space program?
Yeah, well, there's a good one. Yeah, there's a lot of activity going on, and not just with the U.S., but the Russians do things, and China's got its own activities. So, yeah, pulling all that together, my guess is, I think at the AGU, American Geophysical Union, just yesterday or the day before, I mean, somebody brought some old spy satellite imagery that they came out with. You're using a lot of the classified systems to do even look at the Earth and what we've known about it for a long time. So, yeah, there's a lot going on in the secret world. I think one interesting thing about any callers looking at the sky, I spend a lot of time looking at the sky. I'm up here in Colorado at 9,000 feet, and I look at it pretty much, although it's snowing now. So.
Did you have a telescope as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we all did, didn't we?
Yeah, well, I broke my glasses, and I made a telescope out of it. now I got some bigger equipment, but I've seen some pretty odd things in the sky over the decades, and misinterpret things. It's easy to do. I will admit here that I've seen the black triangle myself. I've seen that fly, really early in the morning in San Diego, and I tell you that seeing that kind of object was pretty amazing to me. I mean, it was just. I've seen a lot of things in the sky over the long decades here, and that was an odd one. And there's a lot of classified aircraft. I've written about it in the terms of UFOs because I do think, and we know the CIA has used UFOs as a cover for their own classified programs.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But, you know, when you see one of these things and see... I always say, and the people look at me pretty odd, but it's almost designed to make you feel confused. I can't explain that, but boy, I was confused by what I saw. So, anyway, there are lots of interesting things in the sky for sure, and a lot of classified programs in the sky and in Earth orbit.
And is it a bad thing to have a secret space program in that? You know, we're a nation, we need secrets from other countries, and we need protection. And so if we do have a secret space program with high technology and weaponry to protect this country, I say go for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're at a point, every year I go to the National Space Symposium in Colorado Springs, and that's the one where a lot of the generals come and they give you the full monte of their worries, and over the years you can see the banter increasing about other countries and their capabilities and lack of it in the U.S. So there's the space warfare scenario is a worrisome thing. You know, again, as a kid, you go into space and we all hold hands and peace breaks out the next week, you know, and so here we are, and a lot of countries have a lot of capability, and there's a lot of worry about the potential warfare in space. I'm not sure some of it hasn't even already happened.
Exactly, and some satellites knocked out that we probably would have heard nothing about.
Right.
We go to Seattle next on the wild card line. Alvira is with us. Hi there. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
A second, please. I go on speaker so you can hear me.
All right.
That I had a horrible connection. Anyway, there seems to be a lot of evidence that the Challenger astronauts are still alive and actually using their real names at different professions.
Well, I haven't heard that, Leonard.
No, that's a new one to me. No, I don't think that's quite the. I think the New York Times. I think some publications are actually still trying to. Get some information or recordings of the crew on the way down, you know, and Challenger as they start going.
I'm not sure I'd want to hear that.
I know, and that's. I think that is. I've got a report myself from Columbia, and that's awful. When you read forensics and you look at the, what happened with the people as the reentry fouled up. That's an awful thing, and I don't think anybody ever wrote about that one either. It's just you don't want to go there. It's just awful.
If
Challenger one, I wouldn't buy. I think we've lost seven people there, including that teacher, Krista McCollum.
Yeah. If if that tape were made available to me, I would really have a difficult time wanting to put it on the air where my audience would hear that.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. It's hard. I tell you, of all the things I've done, one of them was I went to Kennedy Space Center and I was invited to go up at the top of the vertical assembly building. There was a room where they had a lot of the pieces of Columbia in this room.
Oh, that's emotional all by itself.
Oh, I cried, I tell you.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, it was when you see the hardware and what happens at those velocities and wheels and you know that this door was hooked to the cockpit, and it's pretty bad. And their point was they brought people to make people realize that space flight is hard. You got to be cautious, that was a pretty hard.
Just imagine the Apollo 1 astronauts who burned up in that capsule on the launch pad.
And I think that's something that, people go risk averse or whatever. We've lost numbers of people and attention to detail and what can come back and haunt you. We've seen that numbers of times. And I don't see that going to be – it's not going to be any different in the future, particularly if you on Mars exploration or back to the moon. I mean, people will lose their life in these endeavors. But every time we've had one of these tragedies, there is something that happens. I saw it in Capitol Hill when I was covering Challenger in Columbia. You know, people will come back and try to refortify the space program. I mean, you hate to say it punctuates the reality of losing people, but on the other hand, there's something happens. Let's don't let those people die in vain. Let's keep the space program going.
I think Gus Grissom, who died in Apollo 1 on the launch pad, was cursed. I mean, he lost his Mercury capsule. Remember that?
Yeah.
Which I think they finally pulled up several years ago.
They did. They got the capsule and brought it up. I saw it in a museum here locally, and that was pretty cool. But, I mean, when you think, here we just lost John Glenn,
95 years old.
Yeah, something. And, seeing those, I was in San Diego watching, Cape Canaveral, Walter Cronkite, and, all these flights were going. And you think about Alan Shepard and, the first May 5th, 1961, here's this guy going, and it was so exciting. But when you think of it today, it was like an Evel Knievel operation. You have a guy go up in 15 minutes and he splashes down in the ocean and, America's in space, and we were so excited. And then you got John Glenn, and he goes up in 62, and, he stays up for three orbits, and we're in the space race, and, we're showing the Russians what we're doing. So that's pretty – and then, the Apollo program. Gemini was a big, a leap in a sense, and Buzz flew one of the Gemini missions, and he still reveres the fact that the Gemini is, a two-seater spacecraft, but all the rendezvous and docking technology, a lot of capability was shown in the Gemini program that allowed Apollo to happen. So that stepping stone of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, it was significant. And being a kid watching that evolve was just terrific.
Sure was. We're going to come back and take some more final phone calls in just a second with Leonard David, as we talk about his work, Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet, which is available for you all over the place. We'll talk a little bit more about that, too, when we come back.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com. To talk to George Norrie, call the Wildcard Line at 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is 818-501-4721. To talk toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, toll-free, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach George by calling their in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. To reach George via Skype, use Skype name George97313. Send George a text message anytime at 818-298-6521. From the Gateway to the West, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Hey, we're really proud to tell you about our television program, Beyond Belief, which you can watch. It's a streamed program. Lots of programs are these days at beyondbelief.com. All kinds of great subjects, beyondbelief.com. We're working on some brand new things for 2017 with that show, too, that you really like. Beyondbelief.com. Welcome back to our final segment with Leonard David, Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet. And Leonard, where do people get the book? Where can you get it?
All the major bookstores, I'm proud to say, have the book.
Great.
You know, Amazon has got it. It is, the thing about the book, it's tied to a six-part series that National Geographic has been airing every Monday.
Great show,
and,
too.
Yeah, it's this next one is the end of the six parts, and I can't tell you, but there's some real surprises in there, so I'd encourage you to watch that last one for sure.
Did you know John Glenn, when he passed away, was the last of the original Mercury 7 astronauts?
Yeah. Again, I,
wow.
I don't want to get bragging too much, but I met, I think, six of them. I never met Grissom. Deke Slayton, I met quite a bit. John Glenn, I did an interview with him when he was a senator. And Schraw, you know, it's an amazing cast of characters. Those
Shepard, Scott Carpenter.
Scott Carpenter, met him a couple times.
And Gordon Cooper saw some UFOs in his day.
Yeah, we were at the Kennedy Space Center for something and at a reception, and he was there, and he and I started talking. He definitely has some very interesting opinions about UFOs and great guy. He was also he wrote a book, and he was at some bookstore and gave a talk, and you know, you realize when he got done why he was one of the seven, you know, because his piloting skills were really put to the max in trying to bring the Mercury capsule back. He was on the longest trek of the Mercury program, and unbelievable. All the systems were going out one after another, and what a pilot he was. Tremendous guy.
What do you think this is worth? I have a black and white picture of the original seven astronauts all signed.
Oh, that's a keeper.
Yeah, it sure is.
Well, there's your retirement.
That's my eBay thing, right?
Yeah, really. Yeah, you know, the Mercury 7, and then you have the Gemini folks, the Apollo, and then, you know, when the shuttle got going, it was really hard to remember everybody that's flown on the shuttle.
Oh, it's just what many of the original seven were Gemini astronauts, weren't they?
That's right, yeah. They brought in some other folks, but a number of those folks flew in Gemini. And even a couple of them went to the moon. Shepard.
Mercury didn't last too long, I don't think.
I can't remember. Yeah, it was short-lived, but it was, again, because of the stepping stone of the Gemini coming in with the two-person spacecraft and getting, you know, because you had the Kennedy challenge of, by the end of the decade, getting somebody on the moon and returning. You know, Buzz has a pretty interesting story about that. He,
by the way, Mercury lasted 2 years, from 61 to 63. That's it.
Yeah, that's pretty short. But again, though, that was a pioneering. That was sort of the barnstorming of space, human spaceflight, in a lot of ways. It was a little on the Wright brothers' side. I mean, and then you kind of more mature systems in the Gemini and then Apollo getting to the moon. Buzz always talks about, you know, the fact that to fulfill Kennedy's obligation in getting a person on the moon and then bringing that person safely back to Earth. I mean, they didn't even have to get out of the lunar module and walk around. That wasn't an obligation.
I think people would have been disappointed if they did.
Yeah, that would have been bad. You know, but he's kind of funny talking about watching Neil go down and walk around on the surface of the moon. And he was, well, I guess it's safe. You know? So, because there was a lot of worry about dust on the moon and, you know, would the person step off and just sink in dust. But obviously the lunar module weighed a lot. So, just landing on the moon, you knew there was the surface was somewhat solid. So, but there's so many stories when you go and talk to some of the Apollo moonwalkers, you know, Jack Schmidt, Apollo 17, you know, in 1972, December of 72 is the last Apollo moon landing, and Jack Schmidt was the geologist scientist on that flight, and Gene Cernan was the commander. But, listening to Schmidt talk about his geological walking around on the moon and trying to pull the best science together from his experience, he's a very fascinating character to listen to even today.
Neil Armstrong, of course, the first human to step foot on the moon, was the command pilot for Gemini 8. I wonder how many people knew that.
Yeah, that one, they got in trouble, too. That thing started spinning, and Armstrong brought that capsule back down, and that was almost a disaster. They almost passed out because of the roll jets got out of control, and they almost lost the vehicle. Armstrong was an amazing character. Also, the thing about Armstrong, I was lucky enough to work with him on that National Commission on Space. He was one of the members of the commission. And, you know, to this day, I just remember him in the sense of what people usually thought about him. He was a little recluse, but a nice guy to talk to one-on-one. You know, he'd be really nice to you and be very up and talking about his experience. But he was sort of a Howard Hughes kind of character. I think he had so much exposure.
Yeah.
That he shied away from a lot of publicity. And only in the later years of his life did he really get out there and start being open and talking more about the space program or his vision of where it should go. But, again, very fascinating character.
Let's go to Glenn in Harlingen, Texas, east of the Rockies. Hi, Glenn. Welcome back.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Leonard.
Hi.
Hi.
Leonard, I'd like to run an article by you that I read a number of years ago. Who knows? You might have even wrote it. it's about Mars insofar as that it may be fooling us. As ever being geologically active, ever having a molten core, a magnetosphere, it alluded that all the geological artifacts that we're seeing today, like the limited atmosphere, Valley Marineris, the lava cauldrons, Olympus Mons, and so forth, were due to impacts from other moons. It once might have had, since Phobos and Deimos are in declining orbits, and there are some low-angle impact craters. Would you concur with that, that it's always been a – it just may have had limited seas from the water melting from large impactors like that?
Yeah, I'd say, the bottom line there is Mars mysterious and we don't really understand it? Yeah. And, you know, I'm still wondering where Phobos and Deimos came from. There's still debate about that, and frankly, there's still debate about our own moon. You know, did it come from the Earth or was captured or whatever? We got a long way to go to understand those, but we're getting better at doing some great science experiments on Mars right now that are sort of piecing together. But I, the purpose of the book was to try to spotlight the fact that I think resources on Mars are there to use. You can sustain a human outpost and do much more exploration of that planet and get a better appreciation for what's happened in its past and where it's going. So, the bottom line, Mars continues to surprise us. Even yesterday, there was a big science conference in San Francisco, new information from Curiosity rover, piecing together the past of that planet, and then the search for life on Mars. You know, we've been after this for decades, and we're still scratching our heads. It's definitely going to surprise us when we get more and more capability on the planet, including humans.
What drives you with space, Leonard? Why do you like it so much?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think it's something that I got interested in through astronomy early on, looking up, and when I lived in Texas, and I saw Sputnik or its rocket that put it up, and I really locked in on the space program, and then the early years of the space race, and what are the Soviets going to do? They're launching dogs, my God, watching that evolve, I think it's just it's been an amazing time in my life to watch all that progress, and then. And disappointments and failures and crashes of things. But the longevity of the program and the legacy of incredible achievements that the space program has given to the country is we can build on that.
Let's get back to J. Allen Hynek for a moment.
Yeah.
The fact that you knew him well. The fact that he changed his belief system from a skeptic, a non-believer, to a believer in extraterrestrial presence. What did you think about that?
Well, as a kid, I wrote to him when he was, he's really well known as an astronomer. And I, to this day, I've got it on my bookshelf. He sent me something. I probably got it back in 58 or something, and he signed it, And I was lucky enough to meet him at a TV studio once in Washington, D.C., and we chatted briefly about his thinking. But I think what I appreciate about him, he was trying to wrestle with the UFO phenomenon, but he was a scientifically, astute guy. And what I appreciated about his views was that he, as a scientist, he was trying to carve out what was going on. So I walked away from that experience talking to him as there's something with this this phenomenon that we need to keep an eye on. We don't appreciate it enough, but again, the huckster part of it. There's a lot of people that are, confusing it's confusing enough probably on its own, but they make it even more incomprehensible by some of the claims people make. But anyway, I found Hynek, the fact that he was a scientist, that he found something fascinating in the phenomenon, and we should keep an eye on it. That is the message that I walked away from.
And the change, though, was amazing. Absolutely amazing. I was a production assistant at a TV station in Detroit, when he was checking into the Dexter, Michigan case, and that's where the swamp gas story came out.
Yeah. Well, it's all interesting. I will say that I think I like the groups that are trying to do scientific rigor on sightings. One of your callers described what he saw.
Yeah.
And the point is that some of the groups collect that stuff, and it's important to kind of separate, aerial phenomenon, some other, whether aircraft or birds or whatever it is. And those are important to get them out of the way, but you're still left with some residue of something that nobody can quite explain, and I love that part. How we're going to get to that, and again, I do think some of this stuff is classified aircraft. And
oh, sure.
Yeah.
Could have been drones.
Drones, I mean, if you take and go on the web and put in drones and look at the designs of drones in the last few years, they got to be from outer space.
Yeah.
And some of the designs are very, very...
Maybe that's where they got the ideas.
Yeah, and aerodynamically, you wonder how they fly, but there's some odd ones going on. If I saw something like that, I'd go, whoa, that's got to be from outer space.
Let's go to Marlo in Long Beach, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Marlo, go ahead.
Hi, good evening to you, George.
You too, sir. Thank you.
Two quick questions. I think you dealt with the first one. I got back on the phone and listened to your discussion about the last return to the moon. That was my first question. The other has to do with the loss of signal that NASA reports and has given out excuses why we don't have the live feed to see the space station anymore. But regarding return to the moon, we're certainly not in a Star Trek Federation of Planets mode of international cooperation here. China, as far as I know, wants to return or go to the moon for financial gain. They want to harvest that helium-3 that's available there. Yeah, and I know when we planted our flag there, we claimed it for all the people of the earth.
So, that's right.
Kind of opened the door for all nations to come and have at it. But I don't think we're going to be in a peaceful mode. I think the term colonialism again might come. We may have moon colonies, but I don't see that being non-competitive. I don't see it being cooperative in any way, not the way we operate on the earth itself.
Yeah, you may be right. I think one thing I've been trying to keep an eye on, and wouldn't you know it, the lawyers are always coming in no matter what, and the private ownership of moon operations, and that's going to be an evolving story with private ownership of activities on the moon. And one of the things that's going to be very fascinating to watch is the moon has resources, but how limited are they? I mean, if there's ice, water ice in some of the poles and the craters that don't see sun, how limited of a resource is that? And is it first come, first serve? You put a barricade around it, nobody else can use it. You're going to have some interesting, there's some of the moon, one peak on the moon that I think they call the Eternal Peak, and it's a place on the moon that's high enough, a mountain, and the sun is always it's always in sunlight most of the time, or not all, if not all the time. And so who should get there first and use that resource? So it's definitely going to be a very the lawyers are already, talking about putting up new legal treaties and looking at treaties that are now in force. So, yeah, that's going to be a great evolving story.
Wait, and what about the loss of transmissions or signals?
I don't know about that one. I have a hard time worried about NASA signals being lost or, there are so many remote sensing satellites up that you can have access to, and people say, well, they're trying to, put blinders on some of these things. I don't see that happening. I'm not sure about loss of signal on any transmissions. I see a lot of NASA TV, and I constantly see them with cameras out the windows and showing the Earth go by.
Do you think the moon landers, those astronauts saw something there?
I don't know about that. You have to ask them. I know Buzz, en route to the moon, they saw some odd things, but some of that's, I think there's even been a
space debris.
Yeah, space debris or even a classified satellite system or something.
Is Buzz a believer in extraterrestrial life?
You'd have to ask him. I don't remember him getting off and talking about that. I don't remember him. He's got some pretty interesting things he talks about Phobos and Deimos and some of the moons of Mars that he's fascinated with what they are.
Is he well enough to do a show with us, do you think?
Yeah, you have to ask him. Yeah, he seems to be. He came back from the polar adventure there, and he sounded great on the phone.
Okay,
and,
I'll have Lisa call you, and we can set up how we can get a hold of him again, okay? And Leonard, thank you for being on the program, Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet. Up next, William Henry joins us. It's been a while, and he's got some great stuff for you.
The free Coast Zone email newsletter is sent out 6 days a week and is a great way to keep up on all things Coast. With detailed program recaps, the fascinating Today